tonight I'll be reading from 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 to 17. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in them. For everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away, but whoever does the will of God lives forever.
Okay, just as a little exercise to get our minds working, just for 30 seconds, I want you to turn to the person next to you and tell them what you think worldliness is. So, in days past, people used to talk about being a worldly person. What is worldliness? What do you think worldliness is? How do you define worldliness? Have a think. If you don't want to talk to the person next to you, I'm really sorry about that. You can just think in your own mind. But if you'd like to turn to the person, just how would you define worldliness? What is worldliness? Have a go. Okay, that's good. There was some discussion. That's encouraging to me. I'm not going to ask for feedback. It's all right. You can remain anonymous in your views. I'll tell you what I think it's about. I think it's about an issue of the heart. I think that's what worldliness is all about. I think that's what John's talking about in these three verses that Gabby read to us. I think he's really interested in what goes on internally. I don't think he's so interested in the externals, much more interested in what's going on in your heart. Perhaps that's a perennial problem for us. What's happening with my heart? I'm not thinking romantically particularly, although that can impact on it. I'm thinking about what we really desire. What do we really want in life? What do we love? And I think for John, that's the issue. So tonight, the question I'm asking you to consider is, what do you love? What or whom do you love? Now, at one level, nobody else is going to be able to answer that question. I've come to the conclusion as I've got older that you really don't know other people very well, actually. I don't mean to say that to discourage you, but we are very good as human beings at covering up what's really going on inside. So the question of who do you love, what do you love, is one that probably only you can truly answer. Now, other people might have an insight into that, and they might say, well, you say that you love that, but I see this. But I'm asking you to be honest with yourself before God, as I'm being honest before God, and saying, what or who do you love? And I think that's the question John's asking us. So in this letter that we've been looking at, we're moving from a discussion of the characteristics of a Christian. So he's very interested in this letter in defining what is a true Christian. What is it to follow Christ? And he's given us three things already, which are incredibly important. Firstly, an honesty about our own sin, being real about that, not pretending that we're anything but what we are. That's the first sign of a true Christian, honesty about sin, confession of sin. And then secondly, he's talked about obedience to Christ's commands, his words. It's loving and treasuring and living by what Jesus says. And then last time, it was the issue of loving other believers. They're the three signs that John's been interested in so far of true Christianity. And now he moves from those signs of true Christianity to discuss a problem for us as Christians. It's a warning, really, these three verses. A warning of the danger of being worldly. Now, when we think of worldliness, I don't know what you discussed in your pairs, but we tend to define worldliness by where you go and what you do. That's the normal way we define worldliness. So when I was growing up, this will tell you something about the kind of environment I grew up in. If you went to the pub, you were a worldly Christian. If you didn't go to the pub, you weren't a worldly Christian. Now, that's just the environment I grew up in. Or, slightly more controversial, if you read the Sun newspaper, you were worldly. If you read the Telegraph newspaper, well, you were something else. I don't know what you were, but you were something else. You weren't worldly. Now, both of those points could be discussed and argued. We could debate, you know, what that quite means. I well understand pubs are different to the way they were, by and large. I understand that. But that's not the issue. Even raising that is a bit dangerous because you'll be thinking about those issues. That's not the issue for John. You see, what I want to know is, do either of those two things, reading the Sun newspaper or going into pubs, necessarily make you worldly? And I think the answer to that is no. I don't think that's the issue. We say what you do and where you go makes you worldly. John says where your heart is, what your heart is bound to, is what makes you worldly or not. And I think in that way he follows his Saviour, the Lord Jesus, who of course he was there when Jesus spoke the words. It's not what's outside that makes a person unholy, it's what comes from inside. It's an issue of the heart. The heart brings out all sorts of behaviours, but it is the heart that is the issue. So in that way I think John and Jesus are absolutely aligned here. Of course they will be, because John speaks for the Lord Jesus. He's his apostle, his disciple. Here's what John says. Do not love the world or anything in the world. It is the loving of the world that makes us worldly, not primarily what we do or don't do. Now, I need to explain a couple of things here, just to be clear. Firstly, when we're talking about the world, we're here talking about life in this world, on this planet, that is lived independently of God. That's what he means by loving the world. The life that is lived independently of God, as if he doesn't exist. We're talking about all that goes on around us that has nothing to do with the Creator, and so ends up being essentially selfish and godless by very definition, because it has nothing to do with God. I'm not talking, of course, and John's not talking about the appreciation of the natural world, the world that God's created. Of course, it's very good to appreciate this world that God has made. Nor is he talking about being appreciative for all the gifts that God gives to us, because God does bless us in wonderful ways in this world. He's not saying that we shouldn't love those things as gifts from the giver. But rather we're talking about life that is lived without thought of God, life in this world with all its attractions and promises that are atheist, without God, have nothing to do with God. So that's the first thing we need to understand. When he's talking about worldliness, that's what he's talking about. Life in this world without reference to God. Second thing I need to explain is the difference between actions and attitudes. And this goes back to what I was just saying a moment ago. We tend to define worldliness in terms of certain things that I do or don't do. Now, there is a vital connection between attitudes and actions. I well understand that. Jesus makes that point. But I think the thing that we need to bear in mind here is what happens externally is far less important than the thing that goes on internally first. Last night, I think it was, I was reading, when I got to bed, part of 2 Corinthians. And Paul there talks about not being worldly in the way that we regard other people, just looking at the outside rather than looking at what's going on inside. Now, that's a good word for us, because I think Christians, particularly in the denominations that I belong to, sort of Reformed Baptist denominations, were very interested in the outside. We're much less interested, or we can be much less interested, on the inside. You see, I think John here is going for what is internal primarily, not what's external. And the reason I think that that's the case is the wording that he uses here. Now, I've been thinking a lot over the last couple of days about these words, just trying to think them through in my mind, what's going on here, what's John doing. He gives three categories of worldliness, we'll look at them in a minute, but he only uses two words. It's the lust and the pride, isn't it? It's the lust of life, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. So it's lust and pride. And what are lust and pride about? Of course they're about the inside, aren't they? It's what's going on internally. That's lust and pride. It expresses itself externally, but it is internal in its root. That is why the question of why do I do certain things is more important than what do I do. So let me just give you a very mundane example. Why do you spend... I'm not looking at anybody in particular here. Why do you spend more time watching TV each day than you do reading a Bible? Why is that? Is it because you're lazy? Maybe. Is it because you're thoughtless and it just doesn't enter into your mind? Maybe. Is it because, fundamentally, at the bottom of things, you love being entertained more than you love hearing what God has to say? See, that's a difficult question to answer. But that's where we're going with this. It's about attitudes, it's about the internal, not just about the external. Now, that becomes important because there are certain things that we do in life that themselves are not sinful, and yet when we do them because we love them more than God, become obsessed with them, then we are being worldly. We're loving this world rather than loving God. The world is what drives us and fires and occupies our attention. So let's look at John's explanation of worldliness in verse 16. He says, "Everything in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, the pride of life, comes not from the Father, but from the world." Three things that he uses there to define an attitude, an emotion, an internal thing, rather than simply an action. The lust of the flesh is the craving for things that satisfy our desires. Now, in our sexually charged society, the first thing that comes into your mind is that issue. It does refer to that, certainly, but we must not allow it to speak only to that, because it's much wider than just sexual appetite. The lust of the flesh is any desire that becomes a consuming passion to the exclusion or the detriment of our desire for God, our love for God. For instance, here's one that's painful for me, the desire for food. That can become a consuming passion. And that can be a very worldly passion because it's all about satisfying my lust of my flesh, my body, my desires. I want that satisfied. So I want. It was quite tempting tonight, wasn't it, with all those cream cakes downstairs. And they were lovely. Thank you for bringing them, whoever brought them. But you see how that can, a very good thing, eating, and a necessary thing, eating, can become a very worldly thing because we are, the lust of the flesh overtakes us, and so that becomes the driving passion. And as other people have said, you don't have to be fat to be lusting in that way, a glutton. Being fat is not a good thing, I'm not commending it, but you can be thin and still have that desire for food. That's the consuming thing. Secondly, John talks about the lust of the eyes. Now, again, this is a similar thing. I guess it's really where the lust of the flesh begins. We see something, we want it, we yearn for it. That thing becomes all important. It consumes our thinking, our hearts. Now, again, of course, that can be sexual. Our society has changed, hasn't it? In my lifetime, the internet has brought many blessings, but it's also brought terrible snares and traps, hasn't it? And what was just, you know, sort of top shelf in the newsagents or brown paper bags under the counter, that kind of stuff, is now right in front of us all the time. That's a problem for us, isn't it? Sex is a good thing. God invented it. In the right context, it's a wonderful thing. But that temptation is always there. The lust of the eyes, thinking, dwelling, rehearsing things in your mind. It can be that, but we don't want to limit it to just that. I think that's a mistake to think that's the only way to apply this. It can be all sorts of yearnings with the eyes, the lust of the eyes. The yearning for a new car. One of the problems of driving down to Keighley, for me, is I drive past that second-hand car shop on, you know, going down the Worth Valley bit. And they had a Land Rover in there for the last few weeks. I don't know if you saw it. It was an old Land. I like old Land Rovers. Land Rovers. And so I'm looking at it. I'm thinking it. You see, I'm just thinking it through. So it doesn't have to be a sports car. It can be any sort of thing you get fixated on. Your heart's drawn after it. If only I had that, everything would be great. The fact that it's probably rusting to pieces and will fall apart as soon as I jump in, it has got nothing to do with it. Still, my eyes are fixed on it. I'm thinking about it. Or the yearning after the new house, the better house, or the yearning after the new piece of tech. You know, the whole phone industry is hilarious, isn't it? And I'm a sucker for it. You've got to have the latest Samsung, because if you've got the Samsung S7, whoa, what are you doing? You need an S8. Or is it on the S9 now? Still 8. Oh, we're all right then, aren't we? But you know, that's how it's driven, isn't it? You've got to see it. You want that. Or somebody at school has got that phone. You've got to have that because you've seen it. And so you lust after it. It can be clothes, it can be prestige, status. We can see a lifestyle, long for it in such a way that we've become worldly. It puts the things of this world on a pedestal and elevates them to a position they should never occupy. Our attention is taken up with the things of the world. And then John lastly talks about the pride of life. Now, I take that to mean the attitude of self-congratulation and self-satisfaction that many of us can fall into. We sit back and in effect we say, I've got it, I've arrived. I've got what I wanted, now things are just right for me. Look at all this I've managed to sort out and provide for myself. Look at how far I've gone up the ladder at work or wherever. Look at how influential I am. Look at how much opportunity I now have. John Calvin, the reformer, describes the pride of life as the vanity which delights in pomp and empty splendour. And do you know what that makes me think of? It makes me think of so much in church life, and I'm not just talking about other denominations, I'm talking about across the denominations, that is just so interested in people looking good, the sort of superstars of church life. I think that's very worldly. It's a very worldly attitude. Nebuchadnezzar in the Old Testament is a good example of a man who suffered from worldliness because he had the pride of life. There's no doubt about that. Daniel 4, he was the king of Babylon, and this is what we read about him. As the king was walking on the roof of his royal palace, the palace in Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon that I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" Even as the words were on his lips, a voice came from heaven. "This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You'll eat grass like the ox. 7 times will pass to you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all the nations and gives them to whoever he wishes." So there's the danger of the pride of life, isn't it? We think we've arrived. We think we've done it. It's the danger that we forget that God is finally, sovereignly in control of everything, the big and the little. How did you get to where you are today? Well, you got there because God gave you the gifts to use to get you where you are. We forget too quickly, I think, that everything comes from him. We forget that power and influence and affluence in this life is an insignificant compared to the almighty power of the eternal God who passes on everything to us that we have. That's being worldly. It's having our horizons lowered to this world and all that it means, all that we've done in this world, all that we can have in this world. Now, many people before me have pointed out how similar these things are to the worldliness that crept in right at the very beginning in the Garden of Eden. The lust of the flesh, so that's seeing that the fruit was good for food, wanting the desire satisfied. The lust of the eyes, it looked good, and the pride of life, they could become like God. So Adam and Eve fell, and our natures have been contaminated by that fall, and so we too struggle with that same magnetic pull of the world. If you don't think you're affected by that, then I would suggest that you haven't really understood what your heart's like, because we are affected by that, all of us in the room. And John to us says tonight, don't do it. Don't give in to it, that pull. Don't be worldly. Don't love the world. And John has two things to say to us, two reasons why we shouldn't love the world. These are great reasons. Don't love the world because if you do, you can't love God properly. Now, that's a very sobering thing to hear, but we need to hear it. If you love the world, if your heart's set on the world, your desires are for the world and what it offers, then you can't love God properly. Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, love for the Father is not in them. Typical black and white language from John. So I'm back to the question that I asked myself at the beginning. Who or what do I love? Where is my heart really this evening? The simple fact is that I think the way that we're constructed as human beings in God's pattern, in God's design, is that we can only love one thing properly. That's how it works in marriage. That's why marriage is such a brilliant thing. You can only love one person properly. And so when there's more people involved in a marriage, that's when things fall apart. God designed it so that it would demonstrate what it is to be in relationship with him. That's why marriage was given, to show us what relationship with him is like. Exclusive. We start giving our hearts to other people, then the marriage fails. Start giving our hearts to other things, then relationship with God fails. You can only love one Lord. Either you love the world and all that's in it, with its promises and its attractions, or you love the Lord of heaven who made you and through the cross, through his Son, rescued you. You can't love both. Not physically capable of loving both, not properly. Either you love God or you love the world. If you love the world, then you need to sort that out, because you're in a very dangerous position. I warn you in love, if you're loving the world, you're in a very dangerous position this evening. Jesus is very clear on the matter. Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moth and rust do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Then he goes on, no one can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Now, in that specific instance, it's money, but it is the same principle here. Where is your heart? What do you love? What do I love? Very helpful commentary on what John's saying here. Now, it is true that the attitude of our hearts shows itself in action. The way that your heart functions, the things that you love, will work itself out in the way that you spend your money, and particularly in the way that you spend your time. That's true for all of us. So, this is John Owen who says this, one of our great English Christian thinkers. How I spend my time is a great determiner of where my heart really is. When I've got time to spare, I know for many of us that's a bit of a precious thing, but when you've got time to spare, what is it that you spend your time on? What is it you give yourself to? So, don't love the world because you can't love God properly, because you can only love one properly at a time. Secondly, do not love the world because it's all going to go. That's the second reason why we shouldn't love the world. The world and its desires pass away, but whoever does the will of God lives forever. Now, this is the most straightforward and simple thing to understand, but we have a terribly hard time, I think, believing it. You see, we tend to put tremendous value on the things that we can touch and feel. I trust this desk because I can feel it. It's here. It's obvious. It's material. I can sense it. I can trust my car. I value my car because it's right there. I value my friends, so I invest my time in them because I can see them and it's tangible. But what we've not grasped is that all of these things in their present form will be gone. My car, my house, my friends, well, certainly my unbelieving friends, all my possessions, my job, my titles, my education, my bank balance, my holidays, my body as it is, will all be gone. These things are not the things that are going to last. Now, this is a bit of a confession, because you need to hear this so that I'm applying this to myself too. One of the great dangers of people in full-time ministry is that we put all of our value, our self-worth, in the job that we do. So it becomes very difficult when you step back from a ministry to feel that you've got any value. That's a terrible place to be in. And that will apply whether, you know, if you're in full-time ministry like myself, or whether you're serving in a certain position in church. So if you've been teaching Sunday school for a long time, for instance, and you suddenly have to step back for that for some reason, the feeling of devastation that you're not actually valuable anymore can be so bound up in that position that you feel devastated that you're not doing that thing anymore. What we need to understand is that all of those things will be gone in the new heavens and the new earth. There won't be Sunday school teachers, there won't be pastors. I'll be absolutely out of a job.
Yes.
That'll all be gone. That won't matter. It's not that it's not a privileged position to be in, and I really value the position, but it will be gone. I can't hang on to that as if that's what gives me value. These things are not going to last, so why is it that we keep on investing our energies in things that are not going to last? I guess that's the question. And John says the reason for that is that we are loving the wrong things. We're worldly when the things of this world take a more important place than the things of God. It's got very little to do with whether you go to the pub or whether you watch films or whatever newspaper or not you read. It's just not really that at all. It's got nothing to do with that, really. And two people who do the same things might be completely worldly in their loves and the other not. So you might go to the pub, potentially. I don't know why I keep picking on that one, but let's just stay with it. But you might go to the pub because actually you really value talking to people and the opportunity that brings to be with people. That's a good thing. I might go to the pub because I absolutely love, this is not true, but I absolutely love disengaging with Christians. I don't want to have any more to do with you. That's a really worldly attitude, isn't it? That's just me loving the world and being out of fellowship with other people. So the issue is not what you do. It can be exactly the same thing. It's about the heart, where my heart is, what I love. If I'm committed to the things of this world and I love them more than Christ, then I am worldly. And John is saying that it is foolish because those things are going to be gone. The things that last, the things that survive, the things that we should be investing our time in, of course, is God, relationship with God and relationship with his people and living out the gospel, speaking the gospel as we have opportunity, but living out the gospel in our world, because the world desperately needs to hear that, doesn't it? They desperately need to hear about Jesus, because this life, as I often say, is so terribly short, and eternity is a very, very long time. I know that's completely nonsense because there's no time, but in comparison, there is no comparison. So investing myself in this world, in the things of this world, in the pleasures of this world, without reference to God, is short-sighted in the extreme.